I'm going to read Luke chapter 12, verses 13 to 21. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.'" But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you've prepared for yourself?" This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich towards God.
Well, it's my custom to say a short prayer before I teach from the Bible. Please bear with me as I do that. Father God, thank you for the Bible. Please help me to speak clearly from it. And we dare to ask that you would speak to each one of us in the very depths of our being. We dare to ask that we'd remember what is said all our lives. Amen. Well, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I find myself constantly reading the most inane things. I do hope your reading material is slightly more profitable than mine. Here, for example, is something that I read quite recently, and it's a list of lost property that was handed in at British Rail depots a couple of years ago. Anyone read that? No, I thought I might be the only one. Anyway, at the top of the list, to my astonishment, was a human brain that was apparently left by a medical student on an away day. I don't know what you call that, but I think it may be the ultimate in absent-mindedness. I'm not sure. And the other things on the list were made interesting reading. They included a pair of stuffed gerbils, a glass eye, a motorcycle, and a wooden leg. And the mind boggles as to whether the same person left them all on the train. Now, I'd like you, by contrast, very much to use your minds now. Henry Ford said, "Thinking is probably the hardest work there is, which is the probable reason why so few of us engage in it." But could you put your mind to this question this lunchtime? Do you think you're a successful person? Do you think you're a successful person? And I'm not saying have you been in the past or do you think you will be in the future, but right now, would you consider yourself successful? And I suppose as we think about that, we'd have a cross range of people. My brother was head boy, 3 A's at A level, captain of everything. I nearly put on my aqua form. I was his brother. But I don't know where you'd be. Some people, I guess, have had their confidence put down so often they'd say, "I'm not really." Other people would say, "Well, look, in all modesty, I think I am." Most of us, I think, would probably think we're mucking around somewhere in the middle. But the question is, as I asked it, what would constitute success as far as you're concerned? And what's striking about the passage, I wonder if you can see it in front of you here, is there comes before us in this passage this morning, this lunchtime, a man who from every point of view would have been considered successful, and yet God's verdict, God's judgment on him, was that he was a dismal failure. It's very striking. Verse 20, I mean, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, look at this parable. Verse 20, "But God said to him," as this parable Jesus tells, "You fool, what an obituary to have." This is the funeral card of my best mate from university. We were at Bristol together. And I took his funeral, and a couple of years after that, I went to his graveside with his dad. And his dad was in tears. This was 5 years ago. And his father, in tears, pointed at his son's grave and says, "What's the epitaph I write, Rico?" It's a desperate moment. Well, actually, God's written the epitaph on this guy's gravestone. "You fool." And interestingly, in the Greek, the word Jesus uses literally means without thought. It's not that he didn't think, he did. Actually, his mind time was full. So he made plans, he sat down, he thought and he thought and he thought. But here's the issue. Jesus says he didn't give any bandwidth to the really important things in life. He didn't give the big questions of life any time. So I wonder if we can, by contrast, do that. So I don't know what this guy's nightmares and daydreams were. If you want to get to the core of someone, ask them their nightmares and daydreams. But this guy just didn't focus at all around the things of God. So if we can think about the dividing things that constitute success and failure in this story, I don't think they could be more important. And strikingly in this story, Jesus has been talking about the things of eternity, the things of God. I've done a funeral this morning, so these things, I guess, are real to me at the moment. But I remember my godfather was killed in a cliff fall when I was 15 years old, 6th of August, 1982. Suddenly fell off a cliff, he's gone, he's dead, and actually that unlocked eternity for me. I remember thinking, what's the answer? What is the answer? This guy, I worship the ground he stood on, he's suddenly gone. And Jesus is talking about eternity. People should be riveted. He says in the chapter as it comes in, he says, verse 2, what we do in this life echoes in eternity. There's nothing concealed that won't be disclosed. It's rather like Gladiator. It'll all be disclosed. It won't be concealed. Verse 5, really striking. Fear him who after the killing of the body has power to throw you into hell. Massive comment. Verse 8, he warns the future belongs to this figure, the Son of Man. And then in the midst of it, I wonder if you can see verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Suddenly, bang, there's a massive interruption. And a guy in the crowd says, will you shut up about this super spiritual stuff? That doesn't put bread on the table. Just get real. That's not the real world. Let's be in the real world. And what about the inheritance I'm owed? Forget about God. Forget about that. Get real. So here are two brothers falling out over the will. You know they say that, don't you? Where there's a will, there's a family. And that's what's going on here. I had a colleague. During a funeral he took, one of the members of the family removed what they wanted from the parental home. Can I advise you not to do that? It's annoying. It sort of puts a shadow over Christmas, particularly if the table's been nicked. I'm not sure. But you know, they're falling out over grandma's sideboard and clock. And this man who is absorbed by possessions can't be doing with the Jesus teaching. And having interrupted like this, Jesus, having been so rudely interrupted, says, I wonder if you can see verse 15, watch out, be on your guard. That's what, you know, it's like the watch out here is like there's a truck coming, get out the way of it. A man's life doesn't consist in the abundance of his possessions. And then he arrests us with this parable to make this very angry guy who's got a writ in his pocket and he's going to go and serve it in court against his own brother. And there's some of you who will know this, maybe families where this has happened. And he's going to stop and he's saying, mate, stop and think about what's important. So we get to verse 16, the story that's meant to stop them going to court. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. So this guy knows all about the EU subsidies. He knows how they work while they last. The stables have been converted into garages. There are four family cars. In city terms, I don't know, maybe he'd commute up from the Wentworth estate in Surrey, but he'd certainly have a house in Mayfair as well. I don't know, kids would be at Eton, Harrow or Down House. Wife shops at Harrods and Harvey Nicks, drives an Aston Martin. On it goes. And if you actually saw him commuting in first class, in from Surrey, you'd nudge your neighbour and say, look at him, he's made a fortune. Didn't just hold on to his fortune in the recession, he's made more money, extraordinary guy. Look at him, he's no fool. Take his advice. Verse 17, 18, he thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Verse 18, then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I'll store all my grain and my goods. So you see, he gets a better harvest than is expected one year, but there's no panic, there's no waste. He's not going to flood the market. He gets out his calculator, he does his sums, he works out it's definitely worth paying for a massive grain storage mountain to be built. Waste not, want not, that's what his mum taught him. So there's a bigger profit, and he's not going to let the tax man get his hands on it. He calls in his accountant, he works out how to invest it, and then, having thought and planned and worked and thought and planned and worked, it's fantastic because eventually he arrives at verse 19. Verse 19, he's got there. It's just fantastic. He's made it. And I'll say to myself, you've plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. He's done it. Do you know, when he was a schoolboy, he dreamed of retiring in his mid-40s, and he's done it. Most people aren't going to make it to that, but he's done it. Age 47, he retires. And doubtless the Sunday Times Colour Supplement magazine would have an article on him entitled, The Man Who Knew When to Stop. He's made it. And as we read about him and we're sitting in our front rooms in suburbia still flogging up into the city to work, we read and we go, very wise. And he's now a member of two golf clubs. He's a member of the Wentworth, going to try and get his handicapped down to single figures on the West Course, and he's a member of Royal St. George's down at Sandwich on the coast. Got a lovely house there. You'd have to be retired full-time to get your handicap to single figures on those two courses. So that's it. And this is, you see, what makes verse 20 so brutal. So brutal. You see, the retirement parties come and gone. Everyone's flocked down to Royal St. George's. Lovely retirement party for a Sunday brunch, and they've been there through the afternoon. They've all headed back into town to work. And he's standing there on his veranda, and he's got a long, cool glass of, what do you think, orange juice in his hand. And he looks out over the bay, and there's a yacht there, and he looks behind this wonderful house he's built down in Sandwich, and he says to himself, "You've done it! You've done it! You've retired early. You've made it." He looks down. There's a little coffee table next to him, and there's a chalet that he's going to buy, and there are safaris. He says, "You've done it. You've plenty laid up," verse 19, "for years and years and years. Take life easy. Eat, drink." And suddenly, there is a searing pain in his chest, and he's dead before they get him to intensive care. Verse 20, "And God says, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you.' This was my godfather. He'd made money in shipping, been to the Olympics as an athlete. I worship the ground he stood on. Suddenly he's gone." Well, they hold a memorial service for him. I don't know, actually, with the amount he's done, probably St. Paul's Cathedral. And the chairman will say, "What a loyal servant of the company he was." The trade journal will say, "What an example he was to his profession." And God will say, "You fool." And I took a funeral a number of years ago, and an old lady at the funeral, she said to me, she said, "Rico, do you know what failure is?" I said, no. She said, "I'll tell you what failure is. Failure is being successful at the things that don't matter. Failure is being successful at the things that don't matter." And where did all the money go? Well, the lawyers tidied up some of it. Mostly, though, it went to a son who was a worthless guy, and he blew it all in 15 years. He loved windsurfing, so he just actually used to windsurf and follow the wind around the world, broke his mother's heart. So that virtue, do we see as we look down verse 21, this is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich towards God. Yeah, what happens? Eternally, you know, the money's gone and all's lost. Now, I don't know what you think of that as we just reflect on this briefly now, but do you think it might have made the brother with the writ in his pocket put it back in his pocket and think, "I've just got to stop and think"? I think it would have made him think about it. And I just want to say there were two fatal mistakes that I'd love to put into our heads, ladies and gentlemen, as we think about what constitutes success in life. Two mistakes. I've never met anyone who wants to fail in life. I think we all want to be successful. Can I lay these two mistakes before you? And the first was, this guy lived as though God wasn't there. Now, we don't know much about this guy. We don't know if he was a good husband or a philanderer. We don't know if he was a good father or beat his children. All we know is, end of verse 21, he was not rich towards God. Now, here's the issue. I don't doubt for a single moment that if you stopped him in the street with a vox pop, if he had time, and said, "Do you believe in God?" he'd have said, "Yeah." He'd have said, "You should see the view from my house in Sandwich." He said, "It's spectacular." He said, "I believe in God," but he lived as though God wasn't there. He wasn't so much "See Ovi, Church of England," but "See Andy, Christmas and Easter." Yeah, it just pops along then. And actually, it's very striking how self-centered he is. Look at the words, "I, my, or myself." They come 11 times in verses 17, 18. It's amazing. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I've no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. There I'll store all my goods and my grain, and I'll say to myself." So he thought he was self-sufficient. Actually, he was self-centered. Samuel Butler wrote about two incredibly selfish people, Mr. and Mrs. Carlyle. He wrote this: "How good of God to cause Carlyle and Mrs. Carlyle to marry one another and so make two people miserable instead of four." He's just locked into himself. And you see, everything points towards himself. So he's got treasure, plenty of good things, verse 19. He's got leisure, take life easy, verse 19. He's got pleasure, eat, drink, and be merry. But what about God, the giver of it all? Well, just like my godfather's life, God's on the back burner. I mean, at some point, he means to bring God back down and sort of look at it, because he does think there's a God there, but actually, he's on the back burner. And you know, really, and this is sexist, I'm sorry it's sexist, but really, if you pushed him, he'd say, "Religion, frankly, it's for the wife and kids. It's a good handrail for them in life. I mean, I don't need it. Look at the house I've built in Sandwich. Look at the career I've built. I don't need it, but I like it for people. It's helpful for them. It's not for me. But he never interacts with Deuteronomy chapter 8. Moses, as he heads into the promised land from God through Moses, God says this: "You may say to yourself, my power and the strength of my hands have produced this wealth for me. But remember the Lord your God. It's he who gives you the ability to produce wealth." He never thinks about that as he plans and thinks and takes the opportunity, that it's a gift that he's exercising. And God says to him, "What a fool you are." Why? Because God is there, and he's longing for relationship with us. So God says, "Actually, what do you think about my son? I'm not hiding. I sent him into history. I gave evidence for the resurrection. Thousands of people died testifying to him. The evidence is irrefutable that he walked the earth. I think the evidence is magnificent that he rose from the dead." God says, "What do you think of my son? And actually, I've sent my son that you may have friendship with him." Now, this was extraordinary to me, being converted out of a tobacco family. But I found that Jesus Christ walked off the pages of Scripture as it was opened. It was like it had my name and address in it after my godfather was killed. I couldn't believe it. And God says, "What do you make of my son, who in the Sermon on the Mount said, 'Love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you,' and then as he was being judicially murdered, cried out on the cross, 'Father, forgive them, they don't know what they do.'" This extraordinary correlation between life and lip. He says, "What do you make of my son? He's come for friendship with you." Since it's the Rugby World Cup, he says he's meant to be as central to your life as a ball is to a game. He's meant to be that central. And here's the issue. Is your life successful in terms of relating to him? Because as I said this morning at the funeral, he rose from the dead and therefore gives us hope in the face of death. And not only that, it's not just that he came for friendship. The next question is, why did he die? Why did Jesus die on the cross? And the answer is, we've not treated God as we should. And Jesus dies on the cross, and it's not just a Galilean carpenter dying. He dies to pay in death and blood for my wrongdoing. So I've slapped God in the face, and God says, in order that we have relationship, I don't just send my son. I sent him to die so you'd be forgiven. A few years ago, I was playing rugby in Bristol against a club side called Dings Crusaders, and I arrived at the Dings ground, and I saw my opposite number. He was massive, this guy. He was built like an outside toilet. Honestly, you look at a guy like that, and you think, what does his mother look like? I mean, the bloke was vast. I thought he was going to be desperate. And I looked around a bit, and he wasn't warming up at all. I thought, well, I had number 3 on his back, but he wasn't warming up. I thought, well, I wonder why. And I looked around quite a long way around. He had a tiny baby boy in his arms. Just before kickoff, he handed the baby boy across. He walked onto the field. He ripped me limb from limb. Half time, goes straight back to the baby. Second half, comes back on, throws me around like straw in the wind. As the final whistle goes, the baby boy's back in the man's arms. I'm sort of stuttering off. There was no question who the father was. There was no question who the son was. I'd like to have seen anyone lay a finger on that little boy. It would have been quite amusing to behold the result. Now, here's the issue. Do you think God loved his son, Jesus Christ, any less than that? Yet he sent him to die that I be forgiven. And yet the majority of funerals I take, people say, he was a good man. He lived a good life. And what they mean by that is, God will accept him because he was good. Well, if God will accept you because you're good, because you're decent, and accept your loved ones, why did he send his son to die? Why send Jesus to die if your goodness will get you accepted? I mean, are we honestly saying that we can get through death, find our way to heaven, and be accepted by God on our own? No, this man lived as though there was no God, and God says that was madness. And lastly, secondly, he lived as though there was no judgment. So have a look down at the passage. It's very interesting as we look down. But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you prepared for yourself?" Now, this is countercultural, but I'm lying to you. And by the way, pastorally with me, I hate it when people lie to me. I'm sure you do in business. When people withhold information to manipulate you, I hate it. And the Bible doesn't do that. I'm giving you this information. The information I'm giving you now is that there is a judgment to come. Please do with it what you will. But because Christ rose from the dead, it means we'll be raised and judged. That's the information. My motive to give it, in giving it to you, is not a power play. It's to give it to you so you have the information. And this guy lived as though there was no judgment to come, and he made preparations for a long time. You've plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. Many years, no, his life was gone. My friend Harry had a pulmonary embolism. We always used to speak on bank holidays. We spoke 5 days before. He had a pulmonary embolism. He dropped. There was no warning. He was gone. And as I stood at his graveside, I said these words from Psalm 103. As for man, his days are like grass. He flourishes like a flower of the field, but the wind blows and its place remembers it no more. And if that speaks of anything, it speaks of the brevity of life. Our lives are so short. The Bible says our life is like chaff that's thrown in the air and blown away. It's like water that you spill in the ground. It's like a dream when you awake. You wake up and you go, what was that about? Oh, it's gone. It's like a sigh. It's so short. And this guy didn't see that. He made preparations for a long time, but he was fresh out of time. And furthermore, you know this, life gets faster and faster and faster. And wonderfully, Jesus Christ says, I've died on the cross so at judgment you can be forgiven, and I've risen from the dead so at death you can have hope in the face of death. And I'm saying, are you in relationship with him? And could it be that ultimate success and failure in life depends on what I do with Jesus Christ? My father spent 40 years in a tobacco multinational. He now believes this to his core. He reads the Bible every day. It wasn't until he was 75 that he interacted with this. And his greatest sadness in life now is that he didn't discover this earlier. My mum's in hospital. She's been in hospital for 3 months with vasculitis. This is our only hope, this Christian faith. On two occasions, they've said to me, do you want us to try and resuscitate your mother or not? How many times do you want us to do that? She's still alive. She's in a ward. But where are we without that? Without the hope of Christ, without the hope of, I can see my mother again because Christ has risen. Well, I don't know where you are. But can I say from the bottom of my heart, having taken a funeral this morning, please, friendship with God. Is that not the ultimate barometer of success in life? Because life is so short. And God sent his son for us to be in friendship with him. We are concerned about success. Success is really important. But is real success knowing the God who made me? That's the question. Thank you very much for listening.
Rico, thank you for speaking to us on that subject. What is success? And as Simon said at the beginning, we thought it would be quite useful to interview someone who has been very successful, a very successful man in his job. But we couldn't find a very successful man, so we asked Peter Haig to come and share his experience. Now, as Simon said, Peter's someone who's put his trust in Jesus Christ in the last, year or two?
10 years, actually.
Well, over 10 years.
Yeah, when my first daughter was born, Sophie.
Great. Peter, we want to hear about that in a second. Just tell us what you do here in the city. What do you do for work?
I run a company called Mintel, so it's a global research company.
Great. And so I guess by normal world standards, city standards, you've been successful in your career. What would be the guiding values and principles that led your ambition in the early stages of your career before you started thinking about Christian things?
God, I guess that I was one of Margaret Thatcher's children. I thought success was judged by money and more particularly the fact that I could get a cricket net in my garden. That was my benchmark. It wasn't a Ferrari, it was having a large enough garden to be able to have a cricket net and be able to bowl cricket balls at my kids. Sadly, I had a daughter then, which wasn't much use.
And have you got the cricket net?
Not yet. My wife won't have any of it. So.
Okay. All right. What made you look into Christian things then?
Well, it was the birth of Sophie. I came across a curate at my church in Sevenoaks. Who I got talking to, and I was just amazed by the gift I had from having my daughter, and thought this just cannot be just purely a biological accident that I've been lucky enough to have a daughter. Mm. And so talking to my curate, I started to ask more questions and went to Christianity Explored.
And you were persuaded by what you heard. What was it particularly that persuaded you, Pete?
I think the facts behind it, the historical facts, I was amazed at how much has been written by it, written about Christ, and how much research has gone into it. And there's much greater minds than I that have been researching it for years and not been able to disprove it.
I had the same experience, actually. And what difference has it made now that you have put your trust in Jesus, you've done what Rico has said, have you carried on with exactly the same values and ambitions, or what difference has it made?
It's made a huge difference. That being said, I still want the cricket net, but I think that my behaviour at work has changed a great deal, and my behaviour at home, particularly with my wife and children, I try to live in a more godly way. Fail miserably every day, but living in Christ helps me because it explains how somebody as foolish as me can get through life and be so lucky.
Wonderful. Peter, thank you very much for having the bravery to stand up and answer these questions for us.
My pleasure.